Our next case is 2014-530, Dale Johnson versus the State of Ohio. For the appellant, Mr. Long.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to talk about why Dale Johnston's case survives this court's holding in Mansaray, which held that an error in procedure must have occurred subsequent to, and during, or subsequent to imprisonment. When Ohio enacted post-conviction procedures or remedies for persons convicted of crimes they did not commit, such as a motion for new trial or a petition for post-conviction relief, it also created a liberty interest for those persons in pursuing those procedures. A prosecutor's duty to disclose exculpatory evidence during trial is slightly different than it is after a trial. The post-trial duty actually arises from the prosecutor's ethical obligation to inform the court that it is in possession of evidence that would undermine confidence in the outcome. In other words, that maybe the decision, maybe the verdict, isn't correct. A prosecutor's failure to abide by this post-trial ethical obligation impairs a convicted person's ability or liberty interest in timely pursuing post-conviction remedies, in pursuing the procedures that one has under the laws of the state of Ohio for seeking redress for the wrongful imprisonment that they claim. We believe that this is the type of error in procedure that Ohio's wrongful imprisonment statute contemplates.
Counsel, we have the decision in Mansaray over here.
Oh, pardon me.
We have the decision in Mansaray. So what we're looking at, obviously, is when did these errors occur? And you've spoken about errors in procedure, but what can you tell me about what were the post-trial errors in procedure, and when did they occur?
Your Honor, that's a great question, and it's the errors occurred when the prosecutors suppressed exculpatory evidence.
Wasn't that at trial?
But it also occurred after trial.
Tell me why.
Well, because even after trial, even after sentencing, the prosecution did not turn over the exculpatory evidence. They withheld it from the defense. And I believe it's in the record, Your Honor, that what happened after sentencing and during Mr. Johnston's imprisonment, really through no help from the prosecution, is that some of the witnesses, some of the people that had provided the statements to the police and to the prosecution, came forward and said, hey, why was I not called to trial? I was a witness. I provided this information.
And where is that in the record?
Your Honor,
is all of that evidence presented to Judge Fry?
I believe it was in Robert Sir's affidavit, Your Honor. And if it was not adequately laid out, that may be a reason for further proceedings in the trial court.
But when you say the Robert Sir's affidavit, that was one of the affidavits that went to Judge Fry.
It was, Your Honor. So the error actually occurs every single day, post-trial, post-sentencing, that the prosecution suppresses exculpatory evidence. And actually, this court's decision in 1988 says that Mr. Johnston's attorneys actually didn't file his Rule 33 motion for new trial timely. But because the trial court had gotten to the merits, it was excusing the delay and considered the merits of his motion for new trial. And what the prosecutor suppressed post-trial, post-sentencing, and during Mr. Johnston's imprisonment were four witnesses that put the time and place of the murders at odds with the prosecution's theory that the murders occurred at Mr. Johnston's farm. They also suppressed three witnesses, including one whom I believe was a detective with the Columbus Police Department, that identified an alternative suspect. And as time would actually tell, that alternative suspect was connected to the true perpetrators of the crime. These are serious. These are substantial violations. They occurred every day. The prosecution, it's actually noted in the Fourth District's decision on the direct appeal from the trial court's denial of the motion for new trial. The Fourth District actually notes that one of the statements that the defense presented in its motion for new trial came not even from the prosecution, but from a deputy who independently brought it to the defense after trial. So we're dealing with a situation here where the prosecution errs every single day. They're impairing Mr. Johnston's ability to timely pursue his post-conviction remedies. And that error is actually compounded by the trial court by erroneously overruling the motion for new trial. Both the Fourth District Court of Appeals found that to be an error, and a substantial and material error because of the nature of the suppressed evidence. This court, too, on October 5th, 1988, agreed that confidence in the verdict was undermined because this is exculpatory evidence. It directly places the murders at a time and place different from the prosecution's theory, and it provides an alternative suspect that were never presented to the trial court. They were available.
You don't see this as having the genesis in the trial itself, pre-conviction?
Well, Your Honor, it actually...
And isn't that, I mean, is that what the statute is designed to do? Because if we accept your argument, wouldn't that mean that any error that has occurred in the trial that may have lingering consequences post-trial falls within the category of the statute?
Your Honor, I don't agree with that. Had the prosecution, say, turned over the exculpatory evidence to the trial court, and the trial court reviewed the evidence and said to the defense, this isn't exculpatory, it's not discoverable, I'll seal it and make it part of the record, you can take it up if there's an adverse outcome on direct appeal. I don't think that would fall within it, within the wrongful imprisonment statute, given this court's holding in Manseray. What makes this case different is that the withholding of the exculpatory evidence persisted for days, for weeks, and even months beyond sentencing. While Mr. Johnston was sitting on death row, the state continued to cause an error. It caused him to untimely file, in fact, his motion for new trial. It impaired his ability to seek remedy for his wrongful imprisonment. And the trial court here erroneously decided the motion for new trial. It denied him relief. These are errors that occurred in procedure, post-trial, post-sentencing, and during imprisonment. This, I think, is the very type of case that the legislature contemplated when it actually reenacted the statute in 2003. And I say reenacted, it's common, I think I've even caught myself doing it, referring to what happened to the wrongful imprisonment statute in 2003 as a mere amendment, when in fact it wasn't just an amendment. The statute was actually repealed and reenacted with changes.
And Mr. Johnston was imprisoned for how long on this case?
Your Honor, he was imprisoned from the fall of 1983 until, I believe, May of 1990. And I believe about 5 years of that time, he was on death row.
Counsel, I think you've attempted to articulate for us a way to find relief for your client. It's complicated, and it would seem to me on the facts, it is clear that his case is a classic of the kind of case in which the General Assembly meant to make compensation available. A gross miscarriage of justice, bad actions by prosecutors and by investigators, and in the end, establishment of absolute innocence. But you had a prior trial seeking recovery at a point in time in which Mr. Johnston couldn't prove his actual innocence. And that's part of the hoops that you're trying to lead us around.
Well, Your Honor.
Do we have to modify Mansouray? Or how do we get to the relief that probably anyone who studies this case would say your client's entitled to, but you've got this legal thicket to get through?
Your Honor, with the issue regarding the prior wrongful imprisonment case that Mr. Johnston brought in the early 90s, at that time, he could only bring one cause of action, actual innocence. The Aaron Procedure cause of action was not created until 2003.
Right.
Because the Aaron Procedure, or the statute itself, is expressly retroactive and remedial in nature, it's designed to compensate people like Mr. Johnston for wrongful imprisonment. And here it's a distinct and new cause of action based on a different nucleus of operative facts. The operative facts in this lawsuit had to do with the errors in procedure, not his actual innocence. Well, we have stressed his actual innocence because we think it's very important to note that Chester McKnight and Kenny Linscott were the ones responsible for the murders and dismemberments.
But the irony is his actual innocence from a legal standpoint in terms of getting the relief that you're seeking for your client is barred because of the prior case.
Your Honor, we would argue that it's not barred. It's not barred because claim preclusion requires that you have and had an opportunity that you could have brought the claim in a prior action. Mr. Johnston could not have brought the claim in the prior action because it did not yet exist. It was a factual impossibility. For that same reason, issue preclusion is inapplicable as well. There would have been no reason to discuss error in procedure as a ground for compensation in 1993 because it was immaterial. The issue at
your
that
argument
point,
is simply because of the change in the law, your client gets a new opportunity.
It's not just a change in the law, Your Honor. I would argue it's a new remedial law that has retroactive application. And anyone post 2003.
Well, not only do you have to find that there is a new cause of action that allows Mr. Johnston then to take advantage of it, but you also have to accept your initial part of your argument to us that it was an ongoing error in procedure by the prosecuting attorney every day post-trial through all of the subsequent filings for new trial, for each and every time the prosecutor answered or participated without disclosing the exculpatory evidence was a post-sentence error in procedure.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
What, if any, is the relationship between your client and McKnight and Lindstrom?
None
whatsoever.
None whatsoever. Your Honor, what really happened, I think this is why the exculpatory evidence was so important. What really happened to Annette Johnston and Todd Schultz on October 4th, 1982, was that they walked over to the train tracks from Logan to West Logan. And they went to visit a drug dealer named Kenny Linscott. They'd buy marijuana from him. And his wife, Judy, was there, a person that they associated with from time to time, and that later turned out Linscott was part of a burglary ring and involved with Chester McKnight. And McKnight was over at the Linscott home. They were drinking and doing drugs. In fact, the alternative suspect, Tex Myers, that was the alternative suspect that was suppressed from the defense for all that time. He was there. And according to Mr. McKnight, what happened was
he was the butcher.
But what happened was Tex and other witnesses established this, believed he had a relationship with Annette, that she was somehow his girlfriend. And he was flirting with her, and Chester shooed him away. He did it actually at gunpoint, according to Mr. McKnight. He did it at gunpoint. And he suggested to Todd and Annette that they continue the party down the road. And so he invites Kenny Linscott along. And so they go down the train tracks and go into this cornfield. And he proposes, Chester McKnight that is, proposes that maybe she will return some sexual favors for his act of heroism in driving off Tex Myers. Rightly, Todd Schultz objects to that. He thinks that's a horrible idea. And Chester McKnight shoots him.
Well, times. In Judge McQuaid's opinion, though, he does raise questions about the missing knife and the .22 caliber weapon and the blood at the plaintiff's home, as he details in his opinion, which would implicate at least your client.
Your Honor.
And so there are, competing theories?
Well, with respect to the .22 caliber firearm, there were a couple of witnesses that the state produced at trial that said they had seen Mr. Johnston with a handgun. The defense put on a number of witnesses that said he never owned a .22 caliber handgun. With respect to the blood that was found, there was no testing to show that it had ever come and was in a very small amount. But the state's whole theory, the prosecution, was that Dale Johnston went into Logan, somehow swapped his truck for his wife's car. She'd been at work all day at a doctor's office. He swaps his truck for his wife's car, may have even gotten his wife and their other daughter, Michelle. Go find Todd and Annette walking down the streets of Logan, force Todd and Annette into the car, then apparently drive around, maybe even going back, because one of the state's witnesses said that night a maintenance man at Mr. Johnston's wife's employer, that he may have seen Todd and Annette there, even though he didn't see Mr. Johnston. And then from there, even though they were apparently walking around Mrs. Johnston's work, then gets them back in the car, drives them out to his farm 10 miles outside of Logan, where they allege in a jealous rage, kills them both, and then does this perhaps in front of his wife and other daughter.
Counsel, all of these factors go to whether he was actually innocent, and I'm looking back at the propositions of law that we have in front of us.
Yes, Your Honor.
And neither one to me raises the actual innocence question that I think all we have in front of us now is the retroactivity question and whether you can now raise the error in procedure. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. I was attempting to address
I understand.
Some factual questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kearney?
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Nothing we've heard so far overcomes any of the three independent barriers to recovery that Johnston faces. First, he did sue and lose over 20 years ago, and that final judgment is res judicata as to any claim arising under the same common fact of imprisonment. Second, the 2003 amendment does not allow him to reach back to the fact of old imprisonment to file a new wrongful imprisonment claim. And third, he does not even state an error in procedure claim under Mansaray. And though these three points are independent, the common issue is this: do we want to bend or break settled legal rules over one set of facts? The answer is no, and that answer is not just our answer, it's this court's answer. This court said in Grava versus Parkman Township that finality is so important to the legal system as a whole that it is more important to stick to no exceptions to res judicata than it is to attempt to seek equity when it seems called for in a given case.
But when we see an inequity, what do we do about it, Mr. Kearney, if we see an inequity?
Well, Your Honor, we're given what the legislature has given us, and the legislature has not given a catch-all for equity. There are a couple things that maybe could be done at best, but it's not this case. Although the old moral claims approach of going to the legislature has largely fallen by the wayside, given our modern statutory scheme, nothing prevents still going to the legislature to seek that. Or, while we don't think he could win under 60B, it would at least be a more open approach to say, we want to revisit that under the catch-all rather than to disguise what's essentially an appeal to actual innocence shoehorned under this error in procedure claim.
Would you address the error in procedure? Because you have to first find that before you're going to allow for the reach back, if we are, to the procedural, the new
right.
procedural provision post-2003.
Right. And the theory of Brady as a ongoing violation hits a brick wall. That brick wall is that the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected that view of Brady. Unfortunately, since we briefed Mansouray in our opposition to jurisdiction, the opening brief didn't mention the Brady theory, didn't mention Mansouray, so we only first got to this in the appellee brief. So in the reply brief, Brady came out. So what we weren't able to fully brief is District Attorney versus Osborne, 2005 case from the United States Supreme Court, where someone sought in post-conviction DNA, and the Supreme Court said, sorry, Brady does not apply post-conviction. And notably, this is not one of those cases where the court could look to independent Ohio constitutional protections, and that's because even if this court could do that under the state's due process clause somehow, and of course we'd be against that, but even if you could, the court can't reach back to the criminal case of 1988 and say, aha, that basis was state law. No, the basis of the Brady claim in 1988 was purely federal Brady, and the U.S. Supreme Court has said it does not apply post-conviction.
So, Mr. Carney, if I shortcut your argument a bit, and I just understand the long factual recitation that Mr. Long was presenting with respect to the case that was presented against his client and then the McKnight episode, but when you consider what's occurred and the fact that his client has been incarcerated for 5 years on death row, what does the state say about that?
Well, Your Honor, ultimately,
clearly he wasn't the individual who perpetrated the offense. You'd agree.
We agree that this murder was not committed by him. And what is one thing about the finality in the system is you can imagine all sorts of cases. Suppose a severely—
I'm just worried about this one.
Right. But the point is, what this court said in Grava is we don't make case-by-case exceptions to res judicata, because once we do, every defendant and every plaintiff and every court is never sure when finality really means final. And once a case is over,
so finality is to be exalted over getting something absolutely wrong.
Well, Your Honor, the nature of so-called one-time exceptions is that they're never one time. Courts
well,
have been flooded
let me,
with
let,
everyone
let me
asking,
read to you what the trial judge said in his conclusion. It has been observed that the law knows no finer hour than when it cuts through formal concepts and transitory emotions to protect unpopular citizens against discrimination and persecution. Fabio versus United States, 1944, Murphy dissenting. It is the wisdom of the Ohio General Assembly provided a In its wisdom, the Ohio General Assembly provided a remedial law for situations like this one, in which a citizen has been wrongfully convicted and imprisoned by errors of constitutional significance. Mr. Johnson has shown he is entitled to relief. His motion for summary judgment is therefore granted. Now, Judge Fry was right there, and why didn't the state just suck it up and say, look, the prosecution of this thing was drop dead wrong. The investigation of it was wrong. It was a mess. It was a miscarriage of justice, Mr. Johnson. So pay up. Why, the state could have ended it right there.
Well, not actually, Your Honor, for several reasons. First, while we respect what the judge meant in that quote, I'd like to quote the end of Fung versus Waste Management, where this court said, even when a new statute came along, that someone who had already sued and lost couldn't reopen, and the court noted the unfortunateness of it and said, finally, we note the unfortunate.
You know what happened after Fung? The General Assembly passed legislation to fix something that this court messed up.
Right, but what the court said, actually, the Fung case came back after that legislation, and he tried to say, hey, that new legislation gives me a new case because I didn't have that before. And this court, in a unanimous opinion that you wrote, Your Honor, you said, we note the unfortunate irony of today's decision, but the law clearly mandates that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be affirmed. This court said when the legislature passes a new law, it isn't retroactive. So there's not just regular res judicata
here. But doesn't this make it, isn't this statute. Law, doesn't it say it's retroactive?
No, Your Honor, to the contrary. The old law, the original wrongful imprisonment law said, okay, we're now opening the door. But when the 2003 amendment came along, the legislature specifically said in uncodified Section 3, this shall apply to cases pending in the Court of Claims. By expressly stating that sliver, there's no way that sliver of we want to cover people already in the pipeline means, oh, and people who haven't sued, oh, and people from 10, 20 years ago, oh, and to overcome final judgments and to overcome the statute of limitations to boot. This court would have to clear about five hurdles to get where he wants.
Counsel, if we can focus in on that Section 3 language, though, it says apply to civil actions for wrongful imprisonment in the Court of Claims commenced on or after the effective date. He's not in the Court of Claims yet. So wouldn't that mean, I mean, I'm having trouble with even putting it in the retroactive context because he's not there yet. So once he gets to the Court of Claims, that will at that point be an action commenced on or after the effective date in the Court of Claims.
Well, several questions or several points to that, Your Honor. First, even if that meant getting to the Court of Claims on or after, we think that means that was guarding only those pending. Because after all, this court's jurisprudence and RC 1.48 state a general rule that laws are not retroactive unless there's a clear statement from the legislature that it intends to. And if that language is a little ambiguous about whether it meets Court of Claims or goes to common pleas, there's nothing that says clearly they were opening the door to settled claims. After all, what if the legislature did tomorrow amend after Mansouray to say, no, we do want to broaden, we do want to cover more errors? Would that mean Mr. Mansouray himself could come back, that Mr. Dunbar, who had pleaded guilty and had his claim rejected, if that statute were changed? The legislature does not, just by implication, make things retroactive. You need a clear statement. And
well,
what this court said in Bodike.
Well, let me clarify then my question. I guess I don't see this as retroactive. I don't think that we have to say it's retroactive if we buy the argument from your friend on the other side, who says, we're not talking about retroactivity. Once I file my claim in the Court of Claims, I'm covered by the specific language. It's not as if we're looking backwards. Now we're looking forward because I haven't even filed there. So are you saying that the legislature with this type of language, if we buy my interpretation and his interpretation, this can't trump the principles of res judicata?
Well, here's why, Your Honor. He's actually saying two contradictory things. The general rule of retroactivity is that the legislature can say for all cases filed tomorrow, certain category of tort cases, here's how the procedure or here's how the evidence will work, but it can't create new substantive rights that create new liabilities for things that happened in the past. So what he has to say is, well, this is really just a procedural way of proving an original wrongful imprisonment claim. It's just tweaking one way to get there in order to get past retroactivity. But then, for purposes of res judicata, since he sued and lost, he has to say, whole new claim, different thing, error in procedure, it's a whole new claim from the old claim. If this is just a variation on wrongful imprisonment claim, well, then he's got the res judicata barrier. And there's nothing about this language of this statute that says we mean to trump lost cases. It's one thing to say we need to open the door to the past. It's another thing to say we trump old cases. And in fact, this court said in Bodike, the legislature cannot order the courts to revisit old judgments. And this court cited with approval Plout, a U.S. Supreme Court case, where Congress tried to do that. People had been losing a certain claim, and they said,
please slow down a little bit.
Sorry.
The problem I'm having is, in the earlier case, it would have been irrelevant for this individual to claim that there was a procedural error, correct?
Correct. That didn't exist.
So he had to prove his actual innocence, which, with what we know today, he could have done, but he didn't. That's the would have, could have, should have rule. But in this case,
Are you telling us that the 2003 amendment is not a new cause of action?
Well, Your Honor, we think it's a variation on the existing cause of action. But if it is a new cause of action, first, this court said in Fung, when a new cause of action comes along, changes in the law do not reopen a case. Imagine someone loses a medical malpractice case.
I understand that. I understand that. This is a new case.
So this is a new case, but
a new law.
The rule for res judicata is if something arises from the same common nucleus of operative fact, and the operative facts are I was imprisoned. It doesn't matter that my legal theory is about error. When a new legal theory comes along, that does not override res judicata.
So you don't see any legal significance to the fact that it was a legal impossibility to allege procedural errors in the earlier case?
No, because if that were true, that would always be the case when you have a statutory change. But this court has said the general rule, and in fact, all states, Moore's federal practice, the treatises say, under res judicata, a change in the law doesn't let everyone who's lost before come forward.
But the operative fact here that is different than prior was the known activity of the prosecutor to not deliver exculpatory information. Isn't that a change of an operative fact?
That's not, Your Honor, because the Brady violation came out in the criminal appeal. It was part of his reversal, so that was available in the 1993 wrongful imprisonment. Keep in mind also, the wrongful imprisonment case in 1993, he didn't appeal that, didn't even go one shot to the Court of Appeals. There were also, you know, you could read, it's in the record in their appendix, Judge McQuaid's opinion goes through why at the time, without the later confession, why that seemed reasonable at the time. And Judge McQuaid also talked about other bad act evidence that isn't in this case, we admit, but does go to the extent he wants to go beyond law to equities. There are issues still behind in the lower court that give us grave concern why we don't want to settle a case like this. But most important, the legislature has told us, only pay when these circumstances are met. These circumstances are not. If he wants to try 60B, if he wants to go to the legislature, but this court has said in Grava, in Bodike, in case after case, this court would have to reverse Mansaray, it would have to reverse Grava, it would have to reverse, this court would have to jump through about, I don't know, at least clear five Olympic hurdles just to try to get there, and then he would go back down and in our view still lose anyway. But what's more important is this case is not about Johnston. This case is not about the wrongful imprisonment law. This case is about the legal system. Do we throw out res judicata? No, this court said in Grava. We don't think you should walk away from that. In Mansaray, this court said, this is what the legislature gave us, and we can't change that. And their own brief says that they want to overrule Mansaray. And given the Supreme Court's rejection of Brady as a post-conviction theory, the only way to get there is for this court to reverse Mansaray, which also means going against the plain text of the legislature and opening up a lot more lawsuits just on Mansaray, even when you don't have res judicata concerns. So you have to independently trump res judicata, trump the statutory meaning, trump the rules about res judicata or about retroactivity, and have this be simultaneously procedural and substantive to slalom through these, and on top of that, Mansaray. We don't think you should do that. We understand why at first blush this might seem to a lot of people like a hard case. But it really is a straightforward, easy one. I don't say that lightly. I know we have a lot of hard cases here, and I know this looks like one. But if you look at this, if you give anybody on the bar exam this question, black letter law of res judicata, this case is closed, this case is over, and we ask this court to simply say so. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Long, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court doesn't have to overturn Mansaray. It doesn't have to overturn Grava. It has to embrace both of them, and Mr. Johnston still is entitled to recovery. The state talks about Grava in the sense of it speaks to finality when it deals with res judicata, but it also says claims which were or might have been litigated in the first lawsuit. It wasn't, and it couldn't have been. Even according to Grava, it's no bar under res judicata. The state just conceded that prior to 2003, the statute was, the wrongful imprisonment statute was retroactive and relies on an uncodified Section 3 that Your Honor adequately pointed out only applies to the amount of compensation when a case is pending or about to come into the Court of Claims. That has nothing to do with its retroactivity. All of the retroactivity language was still present when, in 2003, the legislature repealed and reenacted the wrongful imprisonment statute with a brand new cause of action. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, gentlemen, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess, please?